Hello, and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world and seeking inspiration in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we're continuing our series on the myths and religion of the Phoenicians. And today we're going to look at two more deities from the Phoenician pantheon, sort of, Melkart and Dagon. But before we do that, a little bit of a sad announcement and some reflection on it. I'll probably mention this on Monster Man itself, but because I'm recording this episode first, I thought I wouldn't let it pass unmarked. A few days ago as I'm recording this, so probably about a week ago as you're hearing it, Jim Ward passed away. And Jim Ward's work has been very important to this show, and our thoughts are with his family and loved ones. As you probably recall, Jim Ward was one of the authors of Deities and Demigods, and my understanding is that he was the primary author of that book. And the co-author credit to Rob Kuntz is because Kuntz was very important on the previous version of the book. And it's that AD&D First Edition Deities and Demigods that provided the first many seasons of Patron Deities. I feel like it would be dishonest of me not to say that this show has always had a challenging relationship with Ward's work. A lot of my approach to the pantheons that we've discussed has been focused on the limitations of what Ward was doing, which is not too surprising for a volume that is over 40 years old. And I've always tried to be careful that my criticisms of Deities and Demigods don't spill over into any criticism of Ward personally. I think he was doing a task that wasn't very clearly defined, following a set of procedures that were unhelpful but which he was not responsible for, and doing so with resources that were, compared to even what the average game master has at their disposal in 2024, extremely limited. But even though that work was flawed, I think there are a lot of people of a particular generation who owe their interest in mythology and the ancient world to it, that it sparked the imaginations of readers, particularly young readers, and that there are a lot of people who got a lot of interest and wonder in their lives as a result of that work. And in the end, that's the really important thing. And of course, Ward was a big influence on me, you know, a big influence on the creation of the pamphlet of pantheons, even if that influence consisted of me explicitly rejecting the design philosophy of deities and demigods. This stuff is a dialogue. That is how games are made. I think we are in the years now where the gaming community is going to lose a lot of its elders. Gary Gygax was not quite 70 when he died, and Dave Arneson was only in his early 60s, so we lost them very early. But I think that we may be approaching a time when we're going to have to say farewell to and think about the legacies of a generation of gaming pioneers. Perhaps I've felt that way since the passing of Greg Stafford, and I think it's something that happens as you reach a certain age, the people whose work influenced you start to go. It's not that important people in the world of game design weren't passing away, but that I'm now at the age where the ones who were important to me start to pass away, which is a selfish way to look at it, I suppose. I didn't know Jim Ward personally at all, and I hadn't really kept up with his contemporary career, so to me this is more like the loss of a creative influence and a figure of importance in the history of the field than it is of a friend. But I know that I do know people who knew him and who will be feeling his loss on a much more personal level, and it's them that my thoughts are with right now. When something like this happens, we all experience a sense of diminution, and that's unavoidable, but I think it's also important to think about and celebrate the legacies of the people we lose. If there are younger gamers out there who, when they read the pamphlet of Pantheons, feel something like what people felt when they read Deities and Demigods, then I'd be very pleased. All right, I now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. So in today's episode, we're going to talk about Melkart, one of the main deities, or maybe the main deity, of the city of Tyre. I've mentioned Melkart a few times, but there is a good deal more to say, I think. Now, as you may remember, the name Melkart comes from the roots Melk, which means king, and may also be the origin of Moloch, although it also might not, and the word Kart, which means city, as in Kart Hadasht, new city, Carthage. So Melkart's name means king of the city. To be perfectly honest, I should maybe have talked about Melkart last episode in preference to Baal, or maybe I should say it doesn't matter what order I do them in, because in parts of the Phoenician world, they appear to have played similar roles, at least in terms of being the sort of heroic monarch deity associated with a city. And I mentioned, I think, you know, when we talk about how Greek communities interact with Phoenician religion, that Melkart was associated with Heracles, and in a way that seems to have been true, but at the same time, I don't think that he was particularly like Heracles, although he may have been a god who, like, wandered and traveled and did a bunch of heroic deeds. But if we're thinking about the quote-unquote character of Heracles. Melkart does not seem like the rough, rowdy character that we often see Heracles portrayed as. And we can actually see this a little bit in the way that ancient Greek writers related to Melkart. So Herodotus talks about Melkart, or the Tyrian Heracles, and it's very clear to him that this Heracles is not the same as the Heracles that he's familiar with. And he talks about how this is basically, he visited some temples of Melkart and asked the priests about their history. And based on the timeline, he concluded that they're different. So these temples to the Tyrian Heracles had been built in Herodotus' conception of history before Heracles was even born. So he says there must be two Heracles. There must be a hero and a god. And so he said that, and he said that there were in his time people who built two temples to Heracles. So they had a temple to Heracles, the divine figure, and Heracles, the hero. Melkart is sometimes depicted as a Heracles-like figure in the sense that he wears a lion skin, and he often just wears a loincloth, I guess, to demonstrate a kind of rustic simplicity. He's also a bit like Adonis or Tammuz or Dumuzid. He's a deity who may have a duality between dead and alive. So he may be dead at some times and then come back to life. So Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, says that Hiram I of Tyre was the first person to celebrate the awakening of Heracles. So there's a festival in the early spring that celebrates an awakening of Melkart. And there may be references to this in the Bible, although they don't call him Melkart. Confusingly, they just call him Baal. We'll return to that topic a little bit later. So this might be a hint at the idea that Melkart is your sort of cyclical deity, that he dies and is reborn. And he's sometimes depicted with an axe in one hand and a flower or an ankh in the other. So some have interpreted that as representing that duality between life and death, the axe symbolizing death and the flower or ankh symbolizing life. But then the presence of an ankh there may suggest to you that these aren't wholly Phoenician images. You know, they're influenced by Egyptian art. They may be influenced by Egyptian thought. I think this is a bit of a red herring, personally. This crosses the cultural lines, therefore it doesn't count, is a bad interpretation, as opposed to these cultures blended in with each other, and maybe it's a mistake to think of them in discrete terms. Melkart may have been associated with the monarchy. I mean, no surprise there. His name does mean king. And we've seen some other connections between the rulers of Phoenician cities and the gods, like that king called Baal that we encountered last episode. He's sometimes depicted on coins riding on a hippocampus. He's sometimes depicted in association with ships, so like with a ship on the other side of the coin or something like that. So he may be a sea god or associated with the sea. And he may have associations with wealth or trade, which would make sense, I guess, for a sea god. His temple in Tyre appears to have also been used as a treasury. Now, this was not uncommon in ancient civilizations, which could be a fun thing to include in an RPG. Something that historians of religion say a lot, and that I'm sure I've said before on this show, is that we tend to think of religion as a category inside life. So you have life within life, you have politics and religion and the economy and family life and relationships and so on. But to many ancient cultures, all those other things were encompassed within religion, which was a holistic view of the world or a pervasive cultural and social institution inseparable from other aspects of the state. So you see this in ancient Rome, right? Where I think the mint is in the Temple of Juno, or other temple buildings are used for government functions. They're essentially public buildings. Putting the state's wealth in a sacred site makes sense. If you think, for instance, that priests might be especially trustworthy, is it the Temple of the Vestal Virgins in Rome that's used as a repository for contracts and other legal documents because of the Vestal Virgins, like proverbial incorruptibility? So you might also have the idea that stealing from a temple is sacrilege, which in turn might deter more pious thieves. Or we could have the simple pragmatic reason that if you're in, say, medieval England, in pretty much any settlement that you go to, the most secure, defensible building is going to be the church. It's going to have probably a door that locks. It's going to have a person whose job is to watch over it. It's going to have long periods of time where no one's really supposed to be there, so anybody you see is an intruder, and it's going to be made of stone and probably have a basement. To use another example from medieval England, there were parts of the royal treasury, at least, kept in Westminster Abbey in the 14th century. Now, having said that, Well, maybe it was the late 13th century. I mean, I assume it's actually both. But round about 1300-ish, and I just thought of this, so I didn't have time to look up the dates, but there is a heist where parts of the treasury are stolen from Westminster Abbey, almost certainly by somebody who's in cahoots with, like, the monks. So, not that secure. But anyway, associated with the monarchy, associated with trade. And with trade, not just because of the money, but also because there's a story in which, again, this comes from Greek sources, so it's described as being about the Tyrian Heracles, about how he discovered the famous purple dye that made Tyre rich. So he was walking along the beach with a nymph, and his dog was running along with him, and it picked up a murex shell. And so when his dog came back, his dog had a purple nose, like its muzzle was all purple. Poor purple pup. But his nymph companion expressed a wish for a robe of the same beautiful purple color, and that's how Melkart, like, had to invent the famous Tyrian purple dye. I never pronounce the word that means from Tyre the same way twice. Sometimes I say Tyrian, and sometimes I say Tyrian. Tyrian makes sense, but it sounds like I'm saying the guy from Game of Thrones. Anyway, it's not important. It makes sense, I suppose, that you would get a sea god associated with the city's most famous export as the royal deity of a maritime city-state whose wealth was basically founded on trade. But it's more interesting to me that Melkart has, maybe, these qualities of a death and rebirth god, because we tend to associate death and rebirth gods with more agrarian societies. Obviously, nobody out here taking Fraser as a secure basis for thinking about mythology, but I think it's still a pretty widespread view that there's a connection between deities that die and are reborn, and, like, the cycles of agricultural planting and fertility and harvest. But of course, it may be that Melkart did develop this death and rebirth bit as the patron of an agrarian civilization, not in Phoenicia, that this idea comes from the Hurrians or somebody. Because it could have been anywhere in the many other societies that spoke related languages and had overlapping pantheons. Once again, an example that it's not like Phoenicians set up shop in Tyre and were like, let's come up with a deity who best symbolizes our culture. They just took the deities and ideas that they had that were part of their culture and their cultural heritage. Nobody sits down to create culture. And it's very important not to, it's not very important. It's very important to me that in a game, although it is something you made up, the culture of a nation doesn't feel like something you made up. All right, so here we come to a challenging part, because I can't talk about a death and rebirth god from the ancient Near East without talking briefly about the most famous death and rebirth deity from the ancient Near East of them all, you know, Jesus. And it's a tricky situation because, like, I'm not trying to offend anyone's sincerely held religious beliefs, but at the same time, necessarily, I approach this from a perspective where I'm not thinking one of the fundamental truths here is that Jesus is real but Melkart isn't. Perhaps it would be more accurate to say that my approach to these is not really concerned with whether these stories are true or not. Let me put it this way. There are a lot of accounts of the development of Judaism or Christianity or Islam that basically take similarities between those faiths and other religions as a sort of gotcha. This is a kind of thing that, like, if you're my age, you heard a lot in high school or university, you know? Stories about Jesus have some similarities to stories about Mithras, therefore Jesus really, quote-unquote, is Mithras, and those silly Christians have been worshipping the wrong god, ha ha. I hope everyone agrees that this is not a very useful or interesting way to think about religion, and therefore would not attribute that view to me, since of course my views are both useful and interesting. At the same time, it is obvious that there are a lot of similarities between, say, El in the Bible and the Phoenician El, or that Utnapishtim from the Epic of Gilgamesh is pretty similar to, like, Noah and the Ark, all that kind of thing. The world of religion in the ancient Near East had a complex, if you like, a pool of certain ideas and images. Those shared concepts provided them with the tools that they used to talk about the divine and their experience of it. And many religions that would later be quite distinct were, in their early history, more similar to the religions of neighboring polities. You can see this in the Old Testament, where later writers of the Old Testament are very critical of earlier practices that clearly reflect an immersion in the polytheistic world of you know, this pantheon, what some scholars call the Canaanite pantheon, but the, you know, the Ugaritic pantheon, the Phoenician pantheon, call it what you want. Not all of those concepts are strictly supernatural in nature. So look at the way that the rhetoric of kingship gets applied to deities, not just Melkart, the king of the city, but also Baal-Zaphon. Like we saw this king called Baal, this association of the Baal deities with royalty. Well, that makes sense. A single powerful ruler whose decisions affect the world in many ways. And, of course, from the monarch's perspective, a glorious figure who we should praise. And if a god is like a king, well, then a king is a little bit like a god. Now, obviously, not every faith uses all of these images. You don't see much of that divine king stuff in the Old Testament, but there's a good deal of that kingship image in Christianity, especially once it gets into medieval Europe, which doesn't have the same kind of skepticism about kings in general. And I'm oversimplifying the Tanakh's approach to kingship. Sometimes it's kind of into it because differing perspectives. But no matter what the religious concepts we're talking about are, they're expressed and thought about using connected ideas and connected forms of language. And one of those images that recurs is this idea of a dying and reborn royal or sort of sacred princely deity, a recurrent figure within this group of connected myths. And that image was familiar to people who were using it to talk about what they believed. So that could be Osiris, that could be Dumuzid, that could be Melkart, I guess. It could be Jesus. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus, like, quote-unquote, secretly is Dumuzid, but that a pool of available ideas and concepts and images existed, and people who believed in Jesus and his teachings used those images to discuss the things that they believed and thought. Does that make sense? These people also knew the story of Mithras. These people also knew the story of Melkart. Or did they? Or did they? Because why exactly I'm going on this tangent will be a little clearer when we look at our next deity, Dagon. See, here's the thing. It's very hard to find out anything concrete about Dagon or Dagon or Dagan or whatever. He is sometimes said to be a grain god. We're pretty sure he's associated with prosperity and that he's a sort of cosmic ancestral deity, the father of Hadad, the storm god, so of Baal-Zaphon. A lot of the analysis of Dagon seems to be simply based on his name in inscriptions, so it seems to be etymological, trying to figure out what his name might mean. And one such etymology, which is no longer widely accepted, related the name of Dagon to the word for a fish, and that led to the identification of Dagon as a sea god. And that, combined with his role in the Bible as the antagonist deity of the Philistines, led to the idea that he was a monstrous half-fish creature. And this is an idea probably best known outside the world of geeks in the writings of John Milton. Obviously, the Philistines turn up a lot in Samson Agonistes, and I think Dagon also appears in Paradise Lost, in the bit where there's all the various devils and Moloch gives a speech and so forth. I could be wrong about that part. It's been a long time since I read it, but that image, because it was associated with such a famous writer, became the one that people thought of when they thought of Dagon, if they thought of Dagon at all. And of course, it's that image that is famously picked up by H.P. Lovecraft in his short story Dagon. And then the idea of Dagon gets associated with Deep Ones, and then it's in Call of Cthulhu. And now when anyone thinks of Dagon, they think of a fish god. But from what I've read, I mean, first, not only is there no real evidence to suggest that Dagon was a fish god, and these, like, images of fish people that you will see said to be Dagon are actually different, that, like, they're not accompanied by his name. That's just an association that, like, 19th century ancient historians made. But there's also not a lot of evidence that he was particularly important in the regions where he's said to be a big deal in the Bible. So, for instance, the Book of Judges treats Dagon as the chief deity of the Philistines, and there is not really any evidence to support this. Not that there's very much that we know about that culture for reasons which you can infer. Anyway, there's not a lot of evidence to suggest that he was particularly important even in the regions where he's said to be a big deal in the Bible. It's enough to make you wonder if maybe the confusing things about the deities of the ancient Near East weren't also confusing at the time. Is there any reason to suppose that the authors of the Book of Judges actually knew very much about the religious practices of the people they were describing? Off the top of my head, I don't know, and I should have thought of this and I didn't look it up before I started recording. I don't know when the Book of Judges is written. I mean, I'm sure we don't know the precise dates, but I want to say it's in like the 600s BC, but I honestly have no idea. My question is, when is that relative to the sort of polities of the Philistines being absorbed by the Neo-Assyrian Empire? Because if to the Deuteronomists, the Philistines were part of a broader multi-ethnic empire and their antagonism was like historical, did they know that the Philistines were into Dagon, or did they generalize, applying stereotypes, I guess, about the polytheistic religions of the ancient Levant to the Philistines specifically and associating them with Dagon, even if Dagon is more like appropriately attached to, like, I know I mentioned the Hurrians before, but like the Hurrians, I really don't know, because my specialty, of course, is medieval Europe, medieval literature, medieval belief. And it's always very interesting to me if you read like the Song of Roland, where it says that Muslims worship Apollo. Now, obviously, that's not the case, but the author has just gone like, pagans. Everybody's either a Christian or a pagan. They're not Christians ipso facto, they're pagans. What do pagans like? Apollo. I read that in ancient Greek literature. So I know the Judges is set significantly before the time that it's written, so it's very possible that the different, and I mean, of course, similar in many ways, peoples of the region might have been conflated by authors who didn't really know very much about them or their history. And this made me think about the idea of playing characters from cultures that NPCs don't really know how to distinguish from each other, or for that matter, having NPCs from cultures that the PCs don't know how to distinguish from each other, right? If the Deuteronomist authors, at some future remove, don't really know the difference between a Philistine and another Semitic-speaking culture of the coastal Levant, maybe the NPCs don't really know the difference between the PCs' culture. Like, well, I thought you would know about these kind of things. As a half-orc, I'm a half-elf! Oh, you people are always coming up with these new micro-identities. In the RuneQuest game that I'm in, my character, who has never been outside Sartar, has a tendency to assume that everyone from the north, everyone from the Lunar Empire, is from Sylila, because it's just become kind of proverbial to him as somewhere very far away. But you can see him telling some lunar settler, go back to Sylila, and having the guy tell him, like, I'm from Vanch, or somewhere. He doesn't know. To him, it's just like, a friend of mine once told me a story that he was coming back to the UK, and he had been in Mongolia, and he encountered, like, the passport officer, who was surprised because he had only ever encountered Outer Mongolia as a proverbial place very far away and didn't know it was real. It's not even the question of not knowing about other cultures, but in the case of the deities worshipped by the Phoenicians, and perhaps more relevantly by like the Canaanites and the Philistines, the most prevalent images of them in our culture come from contexts in which they are explicitly the bad guys. Like, Baal isn't in Deities and Demigods, but he is in, I think, Monster Manual 2 as one of the princes of hell. And when people think of Dagon, they don't think of a possible Hurrian grain deity. They think of H.P. Lovecraft's Dagon. So all this stuff about differing views of deities and cultures, it's just me vamping because I can't think of anything interesting to say about Dagon, a god who doesn't really have much in the way of mythology or imagery other than he's a god named Dagon. But actually, I do think there might be something there. Like, deities who are treated as devils in the setting? That's challenging when you run a campaign where the difference between a deity and a devil is an observable supernatural reality. Could there be deities who also have a diabolical aspect? Like, it might be a little bit on the nose, but there might be something there. And to be perfectly honest with you, with the Phoenicians, might be something there is kind of where we stand most of the time. So that is about all the ancient Phoenician deities we have time for today. In our next episode, we're going to take a look at some more Phoenician gods. I know I promised Tanit last time. Well, we'll try and take a crack at it this time. And we'll fit in a few others as well. Eshmun, maybe? All of that right here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.